Now we want to look at the foundational habit, habit one, to be proactive. Why foundational? Because all of the other habits flow out of it. If habit one is present, you can cultivate the other six. If it is not present, you will not cultivate the other six. Habit one, be proactive, basically means that your life is a product of your values, not your feelings. That your life or the organization's life is a product of your decisions, not your conditions. The opposite of being proactive is to be reactive, which basically means that your life is a function of your feelings, your moods, your impulses, other people's treatment. The underlying principle of habit one, be proactive, is to take responsibility. The concept is you and I have the capacity to choose our response. If you don't believe that you're capable of choosing your own response, if you don't have that vision of yourself, if you're deep into victimism, I'll just about guarantee you, you will become disempowered. You will not begin with the end in mind, with careful thinking about the future. You'll be a function of the past. You will put second, third, fourth, and fifth things first, with your ladder leaning against the wrong wall. You'll think win-lose or lose-win. You'll always seek to be understood first rather than to understand. And you'll be constantly botching all kinds of relationships because both parties feel misunderstood. Ego battles will develop. At best, you'll end up with compromise instead of synergy. And you will not take the time to sharpen the saw because you simply don't have the time to get gas. You're too busy. You're buried in the thick of thin things. That's why habit one is so foundational, so basic. It is the vital foundational component of every other habit. Again, let's define it as the capacity, the desire to subordinate impulses, moods, feelings, conditions to values based on principles. To subordinate until little by little our emotional life, which was once like this, gets ironed out. You still may have some ups and downs emotionally, but there is a steadiness, a constancy in your nature to where you can make and keep promises to yourself and to others, where you can treat others with kindness without capitulating your convictions. In short, to where you can begin to practice the other habits which build on top of it. How many here feel better when the weather outside is great? There's physiological reasons for that. Endorphins are released, chemical substances inside the mind through sunlight. How many do better when you feel better? That means we're reactive to the physical culture. If you were proactive, you would carry your weather within you, regardless of the physical culture. And through exuding positive energy and smiling, you also release endorphins. What about the social culture? How many feel better when you're treated better? How many do better when you feel better? That's being reactive to the social weather, the social culture. What if you could learn to carry your social weather inside so that you can be consistent in extremely difficult, adverse situations in pursuing worthy purposes and living by natural laws or principles? That's what it means to be proactive. Tested every day in 1,000 little ways, in the ordinary things. And if we are proactive in those things, it gradually develops extraordinary capability in handling major setbacks or disappointments. But oftentimes, we look into the more spectacular, the more dramatic, the larger issues to see the obvious energy of proactivity. Of habit one. For instance, Viktor Frankl, the Austrian psychiatrist, imprisoned in the death camps of Nazi Germany because he was a Jew, experienced unbelievable indignities and tortures. He was raised in the Freudian tradition that you're basically a product of your childhood. He worked on that assumption, that paradigm. But while he was in the death camps, he began to observe some very interesting things. Some people were animals, others were saints, with the same circumstances. He himself experienced terrible things. Some of his own loved ones were cremated. He expected the same fate. For some reason, they saved him for experimental purposes. One day, they stripped him naked, put him under white light, and began to perform those ignoble sterilization experiments upon his body, and he discovered what he called the last human freedom, the power to choose my response to any condition, to anything that happens to me, he called the last human freedom. And he cultivated a sense of meaning, so that he saw himself, in his imagination, lecturing to his students in Austria following his release from the death camp about the very experiences he was having at the time, about the insights, the learnings he was acquiring. And he came to postulate that the highest value at all is the power to choose your attitude in situations over which you have no control. That was the last human freedom. If you want to see evidence of that, how many of you have ever had a loved one, a dear friend, family member, go through a terminal illness with a magnificent attitude? How many have experienced that? Now look at the hands, look at the number. How many of you were enormously inspired by such modeling? Same hands. I just saw that with my sister, Marilyn, who just recently passed away. The night before she died, she told me, "My only desire is to teach my children and my grandchildren how to die with dignity and with a desire to contribute and to live life nobly and based on principles." And the cancer inside her lungs was like a tree growing up. But her whole focus during the months, even years that preceded this, was constant teaching. Those children and grandchildren and friends and loved ones will be inspired and ennobled by such modeling, such mentoring, the rest of their lives. Between what happens to us, the stimulus, whatever has happened to us, or what is now happening to us, between that stimulus and our response is a space. In that space lies our power and our freedom to choose our response. In these choices lie our growth and our happiness. In other words, with the right choices, eventually the response we choose begins to influence the stimulus. This is what Viktor Frankl discovered. And through exercising his memory, that is his self-awareness, and his imagination, and his conscience, by asking questions such as, what is this situation asking of me, instead of, what do I ask of it? Why are they doing this to me? And also by exercising his own independent will, this freedom became larger and larger, until it was larger than his Nazi captors. Not his liberty. Liberty is a condition of the environment. Liberty is a condition of the externals. Freedom is a condition of the person, of the internals. We have control over our freedom, not in the short run over our liberty. However, in many situations, not necessarily all, the more you control your freedom and expand and deepen it, eventually you will influence the liberty of your life, the options, the alternatives that are available to you. Eventually, your head will create your world. Your response to the stimulus will eventually influence the stimulus. And to some degree, he experienced that. He also had the hypothesis, or tried to look at the hypothesis, what enables these people in the death camps to survive? Is it their survival skills? No. Is it their intelligence? No. Is it their health? No. Those things were eventually equalized, lost, helped a little initially, but eventually they were gone. Is it their family structure? No. The thing that enabled survival was a vision of the future, a sense of meaning about a work yet to do, a contribution yet to make. And this became the basis for his brilliant autobiographical account of these experiences called Man's Search for Meaning. Even a friend of his was so miserable he wanted to commit suicide, and Frankl pressed him, why don't you? He said, because if I predecease my wife, it would make her so unhappy and miserable, and I love her so. That alone gave him meaning to survive. And he would constantly ask the question, what is life asking of you in this situation? Don't let the things you can do nothing about interfere with the things you can do a great deal about. One time, my brother and I were going down a canyon road with a cousin. He was chopping wood and had this axe. There was a rattler. He started chasing it. He started chopping at it, eventually cut it in two. The front bit him right here, at the crook between the forefinger and the thumb. So many ways he could have responded. He could have chased that poisonous snake and driven the poison to the heart. He was smart, quick, proactive, subordinated feelings to values, got the blood out as fast as he could. Many people get hurt by someone. It does hurt them. But the real injury is going after the person. Going after the snake. That's what drives the poison to the heart. It's not what people do to us that hurts us in the most fundamental sense. It's our chosen response to what they do to us that hurts us. Reactive people want to get back. They want to get even. They gather people around them that massage their heart and validate them. and give them additional evidence to justify them and to condemn someone else out there who has done this injury. A lot of people gather together daily and confess the sins of their bosses. It becomes the fabric, the content of the coffee break and the lunch. Highly reactive. Proactive people learn to get the poison out and to move on. To forgive, to forget. Resentment means to live it again and again and again, and to fester, feed upon it. The net effect is to get filled with negative energy, to polarize, to seek self-justification, to look for data. That which we want to believe can easily be supported by data. The way you interpret data, as Eleanor Roosevelt put it, nothing can make you feel inferior without your consent. As Gandhi put it, no one can take away your respect unless you give it to him. Proactive people who act on the basis of their values, their purposes, their vision, don't give their power away, their freedom, their power to choose, to other people's weaknesses. We simply must never build our emotional life around the weaknesses of other people. Otherwise, we disempower ourselves and empower their weaknesses to continue to mess our life up. This is heavy-duty stuff, particularly for people that have had years and years of explaining away their misery in the name of somebody else. One time, a woman stood up in the middle of a group like this and started to give a speech on her own, spontaneously. And then she sensed the inappropriateness of that, grew a little embarrassed and sat back down, but she could not restrain herself from talking to everyone around her. She was just filled with some kind of explosive learning or excitement. And she had positive energy. You could see it in her eyes and her gestures, her body language. I could hardly wait to the break to get up to her. What happened to you? Oh, you have no idea what that principle, that habit of being proactive means to me. I'm the full-time nurse to the most miserable, ungrateful character you can imagine. He doesn't even acknowledge me, let alone show any form of appreciation. The other full-time nurses feel just like I do. We almost sit around and talk about his demise. Hope for it. Wish for it. While we're taking care of him. And for you to have the gall to suggest that I chose to be miserable? Come on. I didn't choose it. He made me. But then I realized how dependent I am, how I've given my power to his miserable behavior. She said, as soon as I swallowed that big, thick, bitter pill, and it hit, and I realized, wait a minute, if I chose to be miserable, I can choose otherwise. She said, I was let out of prison. I was liberated. That's when I stood up. I wanted to talk to everyone. I wanted to proclaim my freedom. I could not contain myself. I just can't tell you what that means. Between what happens to us, the stimulus, and our response to the stimulus lies our freedom. All our behavior and our actions flow from our paradigm. Deterministic psychology tends to break out into three areas, three fields: genetic determinism, psychic determinism, environmental determinism. Genetic determinism basically means your grandparents did it to you. Yeah. I have a short fuse. It just seems to go through generations. My father has one, and
his father. Yeah, I'm a night person. Yeah, whole family is. Don't talk to me in the morning, I'm not pleasant. This has come to the generations. You see, what if I had a predisposition because of my genetic makeup? Okay, that is the stimulus. Between that and our response to it is our freedom to choose our response. So what would we do? We'd adopt a lifestyle so that it didn't activate that genetic tendency, so that our lives were not made dysfunctional from it. Now, this isn't to say that we are not genetically powerfully influenced. It is to say that we are not genetically determined. And the difference between being influenced by and determined by is 180 degrees. Psychic determinism means your parents did it to you, not your grandparents. It didn't come through the DNA necessarily, the chromosomal structure of the DNA. Your parents did it to you. It's the way they raised you. It's very Freudian. Child is father to the man. That means the first few years of childhood, how you were treated and raised, how you were rejected, how you developed deep psychic wounds from those abuses of one kind or another, so conditioned your emotional makeup, your personality, as to last a lifetime. The child is father to the man. And many have heard, once you're 6, 7, 8, that's it. It's pretty much in concrete. There's not much you can do. Psychic determinism. No question those forces powerfully influence us. In fact, for the first several years of life, until the time of self-awareness around 7, 8, 9 years old, there is no separation between stimulus and response. So that whatever stimulus went in here went right into the response. And the psychic scarring is there. The genetic tendencies are there. As soon as self-awareness begins to take place, there's a separation. This space, this freedom and power to choose. Then those tendencies are still there. So we're powerfully influenced by genetic and psychic forces. They're there. But we still have this space. We could behave in ways that might even possibly erase these. Or if not erase them, subordinate them. Eclipse them. Render them non-functional. They still may be there to some degree. Possibly, they could be erased through different kinds of therapies. The point is, you still have this freedom to choose. Even if it's that much, work on it. This whole idea of, I am a product of something, instead of, I am the programmer that chooses my response to that product. Environmental determinism basically means that your spouse is doing it to you. Your boss is doing it to you. Your culture is doing it to you. Environmental determinism embraces the whole concept of external cultural influences. Again, without any question, we're influenced by those factors. Need to be factored in, but not determined. That's why habit one is the habit of personal vision. You can choose your response by the exercise of that freedom, that power to choose, the highest of the powers. In that space are four human endowments: self-awareness, imagination, conscience, and independent will. Frankl could envision himself. He could see himself in a whole different situation. A company can envision its future. That's why they say the essence of leadership is vision and the ability to create a culture around that vision so that there's commitment toward that vision that is common, so that everyone exercises collectively their imagination. Even though they have this awareness of the swamp-like culture they're in now, they're aware, see, self-aware. They stand apart and can examine. If we live out of our memory, we're tied to the past and to that which is finite. When we live out of our imagination, we're tied to that which is infinite, that's unbelievable potentiality, because we barely scratched what is inside of us. And then independent will, we can act on that imagination. We can act on that conscience, the universal conscience, the universal conscience of all mankind, and we can act upon it. We could swim upstream. We could go against the current. You need all four human endowments to optimize. Self-awareness is not sufficient. In my opinion, it's focused on too much. The constant exploration of one's past and the psychic and social scarring that took place. Not that it is not helpful and useful. I think it is. But it is not sufficient. It gets imbalanced if you don't use your imagination to create something new, to find a new meaning, a new value, a new future, and to independently exercise your willpower to move toward it. But imagination is insufficient. Hitler was an imaginative person, but he had no conscience. He was very value-driven, but the values were not based on principles. It's self-awareness plus imagination plus conscience plus independent will. The key is to take time to pause in that space, to tap into those human endowments. Self-awareness, imagination, conscience, and independent will. Then begin to act small, slow ways.
Tell a person's proactive or reactive nature by listening to their language. It's kind of the fingerprint of where the locus of control is, whether it's inside or outside. Really. I can't do this. I have to do this. I had a student one time. Would you excuse me from class? I have to go on a tennis trip. I said, what? We just finished talking about how the language of the proactive person is, I choose to, I prefer to, yes, no, I will. The language of the reactive person, I have to, I must, if only, I can't, I haven't time, I'm low man on the totem pole, look what's above me, the people who need this aren't here, or if they are here, they're not getting it. I was going through all of that. He said, "Can you excuse me from class? Next week I have to go on the tennis trip." He said, "What? I have to go on the tennis trip." You what? I have to go. You have to go? You have to go? Oh, yeah. What'll happen if you don't go? They'll kick me off the team. Seems like a natural consequence to me. If you don't go on the trips, you can't be on the team. What'll happen if you don't come to my class? I don't know. What's the natural consequence of not coming to class? I don't know, I mean, think. What naturally will happen if you don't come to class? Well, I mean, you wouldn't kick me out, would you? Well, that would be a social consequence. That's artificial. It's not natural. If you won't participate, you shouldn't be on the team. On a tennis team, that would be natural. What will naturally happen if you don't come to class? I guess I'd miss the learning. That's right. I know if it were me, I'd choose to go on the tennis trip. But never say you have to do anything. You have the power to choose. He meekly said, "I choose to go on the tennis trip and miss my class." You're always working with an analysis of alternative consequences, and then you're making a choice about the actions. Remember, you can choose your actions, but you cannot choose the consequences. They're governed by natural laws or principles. You may be in some environments where they're governed by social values, social rules. Then you may have to make some tough decisions, either to become a change catalyst in some way or to seek elsewhere, particularly if you've done a lot of sharpening the saw professionally, personally, and have all kinds of options because you are not economically dependent. You're economically independent. That doesn't mean wealthy. That means you have the power to produce sufficient wealth for your needs and the needs of your family. Why? Because your skills are not obsolete. Think on it this way. Two circles. The larger outer circle, you call the circle of concern. Things you're concerned about. Things you're worried about. But then there is an inner circle that's very small that are concerns you have influence over. Where do proactive people focus their energies? Which circle? The inner circle. Where do reactive people focus their energies? The outer circle. Why? Because they're victimized. Look at this person I have to live with. Look at how my boss has dead-ended my career. She says she has an open mind, but she has a closed mind. Look at these kids. They're driving me crazy. Why do you choose to go crazy? Well, I mean, what else could you do? What else could you do? Well, I don't know. Think. I don't know. Think. What other alternatives do you have other than going crazy? I don't know. Think hard. I guess I could maybe try to rebuild a relationship to a point that we could come up with some discipline agreements. What's your choice? You have the power. Always treat people as if they're proactive. The more irresponsible they are, the more you teach them about their responsibility. Always work on the inner circle. It is a marvelous thing. It is inevitable. Inevitable. If you work on the inner circle, it'll get larger. Always. Why? The energy there is positive. You're doing something at the outside edge of that inner circle that wins more confidence with other people. The way you treat them, the way you make and keep promises, the way you apologize when you make mistakes, the way you gather feedback, the way you give feedback, the way you're trying to play God in someone's life, the way you seek to understand what's important to the other so that your presentations are made in terms of their frame of reference, their language, their value system. You're constantly making deposits into the emotional bank account. But if you focus on the outer circle, you're taking withdrawals. You're judging. You're criticizing. You don't seek to understand. You're not consistent. All in the name of their inconsistency. You overreact in the name of their overreaction. You badmouth them behind their back, unaware that the people you're talking to as you do the badmouthing know you're going to do the same thing about them when there's a strain on that relationship. If you want to retain those who are present, my friends, always be loyal to those who are absent. They know you're principle-centered. They know you're just not sucking up to the social value system. That you're a person of integrity, that have standards. You will not participate in negative energy exchanges or do anything that in any way would create a feeling of disrespect toward another person. Because they know that would attach to them sometime under another situation. That's why you would never confide with one child about another. Or make comparisons or quick quips and judgments and labels. Because you create a culture that they know you're doing the same thing about them when the situation changes. No, there's a steadiness about you that is based on principles that never change. not based upon moods that are volatile and mercurial, that are always going up and down. So by working on the inner circle, it gets larger and larger and larger. And eventually you begin to deal with some of those concerns that you have that today you couldn't even begin to touch. I could take you to not tens, but to hundreds, perhaps even thousands by now, of organizations that are going through a profound transformation, and it started with a person at the bottom who worked on the circle of influence, who took responsibility, who was patient, lived the law of the harvest, whose circle of influence gradually got larger and larger. In most cases, they came in contact with someone that had a huge circle of influence. Then leverage, multiplication took place, exponential leverage that started to influence entire divisions, entire companies, multi-billion multinationals. Let me share with you one of the most powerful, instructive, illuminating experiences along this line of habit one, to be proactive, that I've ever had. I worked with an organization for 4 years and was the assistant to the president. He was a very dynamic, visionary person. So talented, so intelligent, so visionary, that it could just about compensate for a multitude of sins as far as the outside world was concerned. But his style was very controlling and dictatorial. Consequently, all the people around felt that they were treated like gophers, as if they had no judgment of their own. Go for this, do this, do this, gopher, see? And they would sit around, basically, in the executive corridors, confessing the president's sins. Swapping war stories. Let me tell you the latest. I had things going. He came in to my department, gave a different signal, and totally disrupted the whole point. You think that's... Wait till you hear this one. Hey, why don't we get together at lunch? We can go further into it. It's fun. It's fun because it becomes a kind of common cement that unites you. Construction people have the expression, bad mud. Meaning, if the basic content of the brick is flawed, you stress the brick, it'll break. It's the same thing happens every time you badmouth. It's bad mud. At the time, it unites you. But you take a stress on that relationship, it'll break it. Because they know you're doing the same thing. The inner circle withers. One man, name was Ben. He was proactive. His life was not a function of the president's weaknesses. He was aware of them. They were in a circle of concern, but not a circle of influence. Therefore, he smiled a lot. He didn't disempower himself. He used his strengths to compensate for the president's weaknesses in his own small circle of influence, with his own people. Very strong, considerate, courageous buffer. He ran with the president's strengths, which were prodigious, enormous. So in his area, the president's strengths and his strengths compensated for the president's weaknesses. Started to cause his circle to get larger in his own area. He also exercised so much more initiative. He was treated like a gopher. Go for this. But he was the best gopher around. He not only went for the data, he tried to anticipate the need. I think the president wants that for a board meeting. I'm going to give him the data, the analysis of the data, and the recommendations based on that analysis. And I'm going to put it in the presentation form. The president said to me, I can't believe, Ben. It's just amazing, really. Look what he's done. I asked him to get this. He anticipated my need. He's analyzed it. He developed alternative recommendations. He came up with one, and it's in the form that I can make to the board. I think I'll have him make it. Circle of influence. Next meetings. Go for this. Go for this. Go for this. Go for this. Ben, what's your opinion? What do you think the reactive minds did in the executive corridors that day? See, reactive people are always looking for evidence. I'll bet there's some kind of favoritism going on here. The problem is, Ben dealt with him in the same way he dealt with the president. Over a 4-year period, I saw Ben become the number two person in the organization. His circle of influence got so large. Even the president would not make any significant moves without Ben's blessing. And Ben read the culture, understood the culture. So the president's weakness in style was being compensated for by Ben's strength with cultural awareness, so that the president's judgments about how to implement this vision, actualize the vision, was strengthened. Amazing thing.
Someone came to me one time and said, maybe you can help me. I really like this material, but I don't know, the feeling in our marriage just isn't there anymore. And yet we're concerned about these children. And I said, well, love her. Well, as I indicated, the feeling isn't there. The love just isn't there. Any suggestions? Love her. Well, how do you love when you don't love? Love is a verb. Love the feeling is the fruit of love the verb. Study all the great literature of all the civilizations and societies that have endured and show me anywhere where love is a feeling. That's the Hollywood culture. Love, the feeling, is the fruit. Look at the love that a mother feels for the new baby that she just carried and delivered into the world. She produced the love she feels. She sacrificed. Love is a verb, first and foremost. Then it is a feeling. Forgiveness is a verb. Forgetting is a verb. I have seen so many relationships rebuilt if only one of the parties would cultivate these proactive muscles. And you have to practice these muscles, like doing push-ups. You can't all of a sudden develop strong muscles. There's a price that has to be paid, and it takes patience. Try this for 30 days. Test this concept of proactivity for 30 days. Work only on the inner circle for 30 days. Smile about the rest. On any relationship, be a light, not a judge. Be a model, not a critic, for 30 days. Many couldn't make it past the first night because they're so addicted to victimism and to absolving themselves of responsibility. See, if I am not responsible, what am I? Irresponsible. So it's easier psychologically to say I'm not responsible than to say I'm irresponsible. But then you've denied the vision about yourself, that you have the power to choose your response. For 30 days, say to yourself, anytime I think the problem is out there, that is the problem. This 30-day test will prove to you the pragmatic power of being proactive. You're always kind of taking initiative. You go home, the place is a mess. You say nothing, you confess no one's sins. You pick it up, smilingly, cheerfully. And then you have a good visit with the person whose job you just did. And you don't give in, but you don't give up. You're pleasant. I want to listen to you first. What happened? You honor the person. You had the power to choose your response. Just do it for 30 days. 30 days. What is the downside, my friend? One of the initial downsides, they'll question your sincerity. You know, you're killing me with kindness and all that. Is this the new thing you learned? Did you attend a parenting seminar? I thought you said that this was a management seminar. Think of the upside. You could become a transition figure in your own family. You know what that means? How many here see tendencies in you you're not happy with? How many see some of those tendencies going into your kids? How many have grandkids and you see some of them going to that generation? How many see some of those tendencies in your parents? Grandparents. I just went through 5 generations. You know what a transition figure is? It means you stop the transmission of those tendencies with you. You stop them. They don't go into your kids. If they're deep in you, you're going to have to practice more proactive muscles, imagination, conscience, independent will, more integrity, more personal sacrifice till they get out of you so they don't go into your kids. It doesn't affect them, their spirits and their attitudes. You came out of an angry family and you're just full of gentleness, sweetness, and kindness. Why? Because in some way you absorbed the other and radiated the new. That was part of your mission statement. You came out of families that did fighting and flighting to solve problems. You've learned to do problem solving synergistically. Do you know what it'll do? It'll back up. It'll start to affect your brothers and sisters, your parents if they're still living. That's what a transition figure is. To stop that and to create a new tradition, same thing in your business. As you know full well, the old bureaucracies, the old authoritarian approaches are dying out. They survive only on a local or regional basis. When you're against the global marketplace, and you've got to have deep empowerment, you can't be a little tin god anymore and throw your weight around and create a high trust culture. You have to learn to tap into the latent intelligence of all people. That's what a transition figure is.